Can an apple a day really keep the doctor away?
Is Tylenol good for spine pain and arthritis?
Do we finally have an effective Ebola vaccine?
And some observations on the diseases of Brunus Edwardii.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on April 3rd, 2015. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine, reporting 2 days after April Fool's Day.
Ah, so you've already foreshadowed something we're going to talk about, at least in this podcast this week. Before, though, we turn to those things that amuse us, I'd like to turn first to the New England Journal of Medicine, a look at a Ebola vaccine.
Elizabeth, this is a preliminary report in that these are phase one trials of an Ebola vaccine. There were actually four trials conducted simultaneously, kind of the end of 2014 up until January. So this is a very current yet preliminary report. And they did three dose escalation studies called phase one trials and one randomized control trial to assess the safety and the side effect profile of this new vaccine. What this vaccine did was it took a live replicating virus and they added to that replicating virus a portion, a glycoprotein portion of the Ebola virus. This particular virus in livestock causes ulcerations of the tissues and feet, but in humans, infections are pretty rare. And if they occur, they elicit a mild flu-like illness. In 158 healthy adults in Europe and Africa who received somewhere between 300,000 to 50 million plaque-forming units of the virus, there were no adverse effects noted. But what they were able to demonstrate was specific antibody responses were detected in all the individuals who received the vaccine, and also neutralizing antibodies as well. So this indicates that the vaccine did cause an immune reaction, and it caused an immune response after just a single dose of the vaccine.
What was the viral vector that was used in this case?
The viral vector is called recombinant vesicular stomatitis virus, or RVSV.
And this is also the same vaccine and the same strategy that was used to treat a healthcare worker who had experienced a needle stick. That was reported recently as well. So it sounds like this vaccine candidate then is pretty robust.
Next question is how efficacious or effective it is in people that are exposed to Ebola virus. To me, this is a great example of identifying a disease problem, developing a vaccine fairly quickly. We need to examine it in more rigorous trials as well, but the preliminary data looks pretty good.
I was fortunate enough to talk to Mike Clagg, who's the dean of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, about this specific vaccine. And I asked him at the time, hey, Mike, what is it with developing a vaccine against Ebola? Is this a wily character like HIV where we don't really know what to target? Why can't we develop an effective vaccine? And he said the reason one hasn't been developed to this point has been economic, that these are these very poor countries, not that many people impacted. And now that there's a fund that helps to provide monetary compensation for people who do develop these vaccines, that makes it a good deal more attractive. So I think I'm going to look at this in a positive way. We're going to have something that's going to be really effective in short order.
You're right. The Wellcome Trust funded this through a grant to the World Health Organization. And because, as you mentioned, it was an epidemic in poor countries, it was fairly well contained, there wasn't a lot of interest. But now, the fact that the epidemic has grown, it's been in multiple countries, and more importantly, exported to the United States and Europe, there's been a much greater interest in developing the vaccine.
And I guess one of our public health messages is now we know we live in a very small planet and that we're all impacted by these things.
As Disney is prone to say, it's a small world after all.
Very good. Let's turn from here then to a very, very common problem worldwide, that's low back pain. In the British Medical Journal, looks like acetaminophen, or as they call it over there, paracetamol may not do the trick.
We've had several reports over the last couple of months about low back pain and the use of either physical therapy or the use of imaging. So I thought this would kind of round out our knowledge about the treatment of low back pain and osteoarthritis associated with the hips and knees. One of the initial recommendations is to treat this with Tylenol. And the real question is that effective or not? And to address that, these particular investigators examined 13 randomized controlled trials that looked at the effectiveness of acetaminophen or Tylenol versus placebo. And what they discovered was that there was very high quality evidence showing that acetaminophen was ineffective for reducing the intensity of pain or improving the quality of life in the short term in people with low back pain. And those with hip or knee osteoarthritis, although there was a significant improvement, it was clinically unimportant. You say, what is that about? Well, on a scale of 0 to 100, someone rates their pain, those that received Tylenol or acetaminophen had a 4-point decrease in the intensity of pain in their hips or knees. But clinically, that's not really very relevant at all. What was important is that people that took a medicine were 4 times more likely to have abnormal liver function tests.
This is really too bad, of course, because we like acetaminophen. It's cheap, it's available over the counter. But gosh, we're seeing an emerging body of evidence regarding its impact on liver function. So well worth considering, I guess, when reaching for that bottle.
There are other options that are effective. Oral non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs, but there are also topical NSAIDs that are effective. We have good evidence that physical therapy, physical activity, optimizing weight, maintaining exercise is actually beneficial in these individuals as well.
On that good news note then, let's turn to something else. This popular myth been around as long as I've been on the planet, I'm sure as long as you've been around as well. If we consume an apple a day, will that keep the doctor away? Believe it or not, in JAMA Internal Medicine.
So this was a tongue-in-cheek study done on April Fool's Day to inject a little bit of science and humor. And as you said, for over a century, the wisdom has been that an apple a day keeps the doctor away. It actually started with the phrase, eat an apple on going to bed, and you'll keep the doctor from earning his bread. So to attempt to answer whether this was in fact true, they did a cross-sectional study looking at the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, the NHANES, which has been used for a number of things. They looked at over 8,700 adults who filled out the survey between 2007 and 2010, and they compared daily apple eaters versus the non-apple eaters. 9% of the individuals were apple eaters, and the remainder were not. What they discovered was, after adjusting for socioeconomic and health-related characteristics, there was no association between the number of physician visits and apples. However, apple eaters were marginally more successful at avoiding prescription medications. So an apple a day doesn't keep the doctor away, but an apple a day may keep the pharmacist away.
Okay. In this particular study, were there any other fruits that were examined or vegetables that were examined for their capacity to keep us from the maw of the medical system?
No, in fact, it was only apples. As you might surmise, the apple eaters were a little bit different than the non-apple eaters in that they were more likely to eat healthy. They had a higher educational attainment. And interestingly enough, they were more likely to be from a racial or ethnic minority and less likely to smoke. If you know of another aphorism dealing with another vegetable or fruit, we'll submit it to the investigators to study next April Fool's Day.
Very good. Finally then, let's turn to our really just very frank pay-in to April Fool's Day. That's a look at this condition, Brunus Edwardii. That's in the veterinary record from April 1st, 1972.
Now, Elizabeth, this will be a first for us. We report on current studies, those that are reported the week that we do the podcast. This one, however, was reported almost 40 years ago. But it's still a condition that's still prevalent across the world, and I'm not sure many of our listeners are aware of it. So I thought it would be important to discuss some observations on the diseases of Brunus Edwardii. That's the specific name of the species. The species is genetically homogenous. The specific term Brunus Edwardii may not be recognizable to our listeners, but the more familiar term, Brunus meaning bear, Edwardii being teddy, may be more familiar. So this is observations on the diseases of teddy bears. And why this is important is at least 63.8% of households are inhabited by one or more of these particular species. So they report, after examining 1,598 species of Brunus Edwardii, they reported in several different cases. Case one was a 6-month-old bear who was mute, unable to speak, had a wrenched neck, and was missing a lower limb. And it appeared that the injury had been the result of sudden acute trauma related to disputed ownership. There's another one that suffered from soggy ear, owned by a 6-month-old who slept with the ear firmly clamped in their mouth. And the treatment for this was to remove the bear once the infant had fallen asleep. Another bear had a distinctive cheesy odor and a dried white coating. Analysis revealed it was Lactobacillus acidophilus yogurt. spilled on the bear. And finally, there was one bear that was suffering from severe emotional distress. Apparently, he had an ocular prolapse. That is, his eye had been removed, and in his place, a button had been sewn. The bear had, obviously, emotional distress. It looked like a persistent squint. So I want to make our listeners aware that these species, if they inhabit your home, there are a number of different disorders or diseases that may afflict Brunus edwardii.
On that very lighthearted and really kind of fun note, I will say that if I can find it, if I can get the reference, I definitely will put that one on the blog as the feature this week. Happy April Fool's Day, a couple days late, Rick. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well and laugh often.